Hello, this is For Art's Sake, a podcast that gives voice to museum people. Here we discover the untold stories, for art's sake and for your sake. In today's episode, we have the pleasure of introducing a new guest, and we're also welcoming Sibylla as our host. Sibylla has been a key part of our team behind the scenes and will be joining us for this episode and more. So let's introduce our guest. We're delighted to have Gervais Chu with us. Gervais is the Deputy Director for Organizational Design and Innovation at Singapore's National Heritage Board. What exactly does that mean? In simple terms, Gervais is turning museums into interactive and technology-driven adventures. Think of it like having a conversation with an AI museum guide or stepping into history with virtual reality. That's the kind of dynamic experience Gervais is creating. So back in 2017, he initiated DigiMuse, a project that integrates digital technologies into cultural and heritage sectors. But his work is about more than just technology. It's really about making cultural places accessible and relevant. We'll be talking to Gervais about his work and also how he's using technology to give museums a fresh and exciting spin. And we're particularly eager to learn how he manages this delicate balance between tradition and innovation. Gervais, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us, Gervais. So that was a quick introduction that we always make in the beginning of our podcast, but obviously we'd love to hear more about you in your own words. So tell us, what brought you into the cultural sector?
Yeah, thanks very much. And I think it's really exciting to be here and to be able to share my, I guess, background experiences in this field. As I didn't come into the sort of like arts and culture scene naturally, or rather I should say my career didn't start off on this front. That being said, I think from an undergraduate university perspective and all that, I read political science and literature. So it was always that interest in the arts. It's just that from there, I started my career more in the military and in aviation. So I spent probably about 10 years, I guess, in military and aviation before coming in to arts and culture. And it's really an exciting field for me. And the switch is in itself is interesting because people don't necessarily associate the two, military, airports, aviation. It seems quite far removed, really, from arts and culture. But to me, I guess this is where I have found my interest aligning, really, with what we see as emerging trends, in culture, in arts, and the thread that connects it really is technology, digitalization, and I think that's where I've found a lot of synergy and interest, in my experience or my prior experience, as well as what I'm doing now.
And as you said, you began your career in the military and aviation, and specifically you worked as a warfare officer in the Singapore Air Force and then as an airport manager for civil aviation. And this is, once again, as you've mentioned, this is all before transitioning into the arts sector. And it is quite a unique path. But can you tell us what really prompted this significant career shift? What was the aha moment? Yeah,
I think for me, the shift, really moving into arts, culture and heritage is really prompted by the desire to kind of connect, really a lot more with people, with heritage, with tradition, with culture. And that was really the motivating factor for me, to kind of venture into arts and culture. It's also sparked really from a continuation of my prior experiences where I started to do a lot more in the area of, I guess, experiences. So if you look at it from a airport operations perspective, even though you don't naturally make that connection, a lot of the airport experience is really about ensuring that people who come through the airport have a great time. Right? They're able to connect with each other. They're able to connect with the history of the place in terms of that they are transiting through. And a lot of that sparked really my interest to say, hey, what else can I do beyond kind of touching people at the airports or or in the work that I do? How else can I extend that experience? And I think museums seem to be a natural extension. And likewise, I think if you look at it from the work that the Heritage Board does, a lot of it is about protecting traditions. It's about kind of proliferating culture and really about the human experience.
So interestingly enough, it's, I suppose in Singapore, it is pretty much the same as in the Western world. People come with traditional background and a history, but then there are exceptions, which I personally find quite refreshing. But given your diverse background, are there any skills or lessons from your military or civil service that you found surprisingly valuable or helpful in your work in the cultural sector? And you've just mentioned airport experience, right? And also to us personally, the first thing that comes to mind is discipline. But are there any other, let's say, skills you are benefiting from right now?
I would say, maybe I'll touch it sequentially. I think from the military background, I enjoy my work in the military. I think it was a great experience for me. And what I was able to take away from it is really the notion of looking forward, you know, because at least in my role then, I was looking at things like strategic master planning, you know, planning for systems development with a 10-year, 15-year horizon. So it's not just dealing with the operational stuff. It's not just about the discipline, but really it's about having a long-term vision, you know, for how we wanted to develop, you know, in this case, the military. And I have found that very useful because as I bring that kind of experience into what the work that I do now, a lot of it is about that. It's about anticipating trends, anticipating what are the needs, you know, that arts and culture institutions might face, you know, and not just from an immediate 1-2 year horizon, but really looking forward, you know, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, where are the opportunities, where are the kind of interesting innovations that we should tap on. So that, I guess, from the military perspective, was particularly relevant, you know, I feel, you know, in the work that I do. From the airport perspective, I think our airport is notably one of the best in the world, if not the best, consistently. And that really sets, for me, I mean, my experience takeaway from it is a certain expectation of standards. And it's also about that human touch. You know, so it's not just an airport as a function, you know, meaning that just for people to come through, but really the whole entire airport experience, you know, as I had gone through it, was really about touching every single person, you know, and everyone who comes through the airport needs to feel something, right? And that, I think, that expectation of standards, the expectation of the human touch, you know, and that connection with everybody that comes through and making that really an emotional and memorable experience, that stayed with me. And as I kind of came in then to the Heritage Board and we start looking at, oh, museums, what might a museum experience be, right? How might we make the festivals better? Now, how can we employ technologies to kind of help enhance the human experience? I think these are really relevant that I have brought over from those fields, which you don't typically think about, right? As I say, you kind of see it as pretty diverse. So that's a very common kind of question that I get every time I share my background. It's like, hey, you know, you don't come from a traditional background, and how do you actually land up in arts and culture?
And on that note, we'd love to hear more about your role at the National Heritage Board. So right now, you are the Deputy Director of Organizational Design and Innovation at Singapore's National Heritage Board. So for those who might not be familiar with it, could you clarify what your organization does?
So the National Heritage Board, essentially we're a statutory board under the sort of public service. So we are funded by public money. Our mandate really is to kind of protect, preserve history, heritage, you know, our legacies. And I would say functionally, there are a few areas. So, in one case, the most visible to most people is that we manage the museums. And I think directly, the National Heritage Board manages about 9 museums in Singapore, including the National Museum of Singapore, the Asian Civilizations Museum, the Peranakan Museum, you know, and a few others. So that's one function. You know, so we do look after and directly manage some of the larger museums in Singapore. That being said, we also have other roles, including, you know, safeguarding of tangible and intangible cultural heritage. We look at education and outreach, you know, working with the schools to ensure that, you know, heritage education is embedded, you know, really as part of the learning experience across, you know, I guess, different age groups. We also look at things like preservation of sites and monuments. You know, we gazette the national monuments in Singapore and a whole variety of other kind of more, I guess, promotional or even, I guess, regulatory roles. I think one big area that I was involved in a lot is really the festivals and precinct development, as we call it, or precinct management. So in my early years with the Heritage Board, I started off looking or managing the Singapore Heritage Festival as well as the Singapore Night Festival, and also so place manager for the Bras Basah Bugis precinct. So these are also other functions that we take on, really with the intention or with the objective of ensuring that our heritage, you know, is accessible to all, you know, is able to be preserved, and people basically feel proud, you know, of their heritage.
Thank you for explaining the role of the National Heritage Board, Gervais. And to help us understand better, could you compare the National Heritage Board with similar institutions worldwide?
I think there are similar setups across every country. I think probably named differently, but really handling about the same kind of role. So I guess in, let's say if you would take the UK's context, it would be the National Arts Trust or the Heritage Trust. And those are the entities that, you know, are really responsible for that. And similarly, I think if you look at every country, you know, that we've been to, there is a ministry or a statutory board that basically looks after, you know, cultural heritage. Yeah, so it's not dissimilar from all other setups. I think what may be a little bit different in that sense is that for NHB, or as we call it, the acronym we use, we are also very directly involved in running the museums. You know, so, and that may not be a typical setup for a lot of statutory boards, because a lot of them play more of a regulatory role. You know, they kind of try to promote the industry, but may not necessarily directly run a lot of the museums.
It's really interesting to see how it's so similar to many organizations around the world, but at the same time, you have that unique point where you run the museums as well, which is something that we don't really see in many parts of the world, really. So from what we hear from your story, it seems like you've dedicated a large part of your career preserving and promoting cultural heritage, which are, let's face it, it's a pretty monumental task. Can you share with us why you think this work is so crucial, preserving and promoting cultural heritage?
To me, you know, arts and culture or cultural heritage in general is an area that's essential to the human experience, you know, to the way we understand and connect with each other. I mean, being a history student, you know, or someone who has read political science literature, I think we do see this as a very basic kind of requirement, you know, in a way for all of us to be able to appreciate and to have the empathy with each other, you know, and then arts and culture is really that thread that connects all of this, in my opinion. And I think what we also find, you know, is that there is a lot of perspective and many different aspects of heritage. And this is something we struggle with as well. You know, sometimes we talk about heritage being the larger narrative, you know, and it's like, oh, the history of a nation, how kind of, I guess, people have, you know, come together or separated and so on. But that's really the larger kind of narrative. But at the same time, as we dive deeper into the work that we do, we realize that there are a lot of what I would call micro histories, right? It's really about the kind of heritage of subcultures, you know, or different groups who may not necessarily have the platform to share their stories. And I think those are the ones that I personally find very important, you know, that we come in and also play a role to ensure that their stories, their histories are preserved and shared and is not lost to time, right? So Singapore, for instance, I think we are a very young nation. I think we were basically, we only got independence in 1965. But prior to that, you know, if you look at it, we do have a much longer history in the overall scheme of things, whether it's as part of Malaya or even during the colonial period or even the pre-colonial period. I think typically at the National Museum, for instance, we make a huge effort to kind of share that, you know, our history started, you know, 700 years ago, right? If you really trace back then, even though we are a young nation, it doesn't mean that our history started only when we became independent. So that connection, I think, particularly with the region, with ASEAN, for example, with our neighbors, you know, with Indonesia, with Malaysia, I think that's a sort of kinship and a kindred spirit that needs to come through, and those stories need to be told as well. I guess really looking at history or heritage in isolation, but really the connections and the evolution of it that I find really interesting. And therein, I suppose, is the crux of it, right? The storytelling, you know, the way that you connect this and transmit this down to the next generation so that they are able to transmit it down to the next generation and start to see, you know, the connections and realize that they do not exist in isolation. I think that's very important. So that really is one of the kind of prime motivations for me in the work that I do.
Thank you, Gervais. And well, right now at this stage, we've talked quite a bit about the National Heritage Board and digested what heritage means and about your view and in the context of Singapore. But we're also interested to hear about your previous jobs and in your previous role as the Deputy Director for the National Museum of Singapore. We heard that you were involved in the so-called DigiMuse project that we've mentioned. Were you responsible for the digital transformation of 9 museums in Singapore? So can you tell us what exactly you did? And please correct me, but you're still doing in this project.
So for me, maybe I think a good way to understand it is when I started off with the Heritage Board, it was in various roles that I mentioned, whether it's in festivals or industry development and precinct development and all that. But somewhere, I think in 2014 or so, I took on the appointment as in the National Museum of Singapore. And I think it's in that particular role that I started to have the space to play with, you know, in terms of physically, you know, having a museum and the spaces within a museum to kind of start to test it and, you know, have various ideas come to life with regards to, you know, digital innovation. So what happened was I first started looking around and I realized that there wasn't a lot of things happening at that point in time with regards to technology and arts and culture coming together. There was a lot of focus on technology, you know, a lot of focus on, you know, what it means to be a smart nation, you know, as the Singapore terminology is. But a lot of the focus on the technology and tended to focus at that point in time on fintech, for example, financial tech or medtech, you know, medical technologies. Still the case.
I was about to add, sorry, I had to mute myself. Still the case.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And I think, but no, as I started looking at it, I was like, hey, you know, but this is, there seems to be a missing piece here, right? I mean, technology on its own is great. I mean, and I think that it's great that there's relevance in fintech and medtech, but, you know, what about, you know, arts and culture? What about, you know, what it means to be able to connect, you know, to individuals, to people across, you know, thematics that may be more inspiring, I guess, to a lot of people as well. So there was a gap that I felt was there, and I then started the DigiMuse initiative and really appreciate my bosses, you know, at that point in time for supporting it, because it wasn't really on the radar, but it was something that I felt I wanted to do, and they supported my, I guess, intention to do so. So I started DigiMuse, and with the intention to basically do two things. One, to bring in a lot of whatever I can from the world, you know, to Singapore to share what are the great initiatives in digital innovation that's been practiced across museums or arts and culture scenes internationally. So we started off, for example, with an international symposium where we also brought in a lot of creators in virtual reality, and they were able to kind of showcase, you know, their projects in Singapore through the DigiMuse program. And that really was the starting point, you know, for us to then engage with the local arts and culture community to get them to see, hey, you know, these are things that other people are doing out there. You know, do you see potential in it? So that was really the first phase, really about education, really about bringing in, you know, really great projects so that we start to engage with the local communities, local artistic communities in particular. The second phase of it was then to get our local creators to pair up, you know, with technologies, you know, artists, to come together and then create projects that are meaningful, you know, to the sector. And I think that's where the, as part of the DigiMuse project, I think we were very proud to have supported, you know, quite a number of projects in terms of that have come up organically from the local artists to be presented at the National Museum of Singapore. Yeah, so maybe I'll just give two or three examples. So in the earliest, when we did DigiMuse, we also did an open call for proposals, and it was done in two categories. So we had an open call for proposals, one in the area of arts and creatives, you know, so basically for artists and creatives to come in and present, you know, interesting ideas for how technology has actually influenced their practice or could influence their practice. And we seeded, I think, about four or five projects in that field. The other kind of category that we put up was more on museum experience. You know, how can technology change the visitor experience or the museum experience for people? So not necessarily from an artistic perspective, but more from a functional perspective. And I think it's in that initial call that even today, you know, I find that has actually influenced how we have looked at technology now, because it just even from that initial open call, we had ideas, you know, ranging from artificial intelligence to chatbots to virtual reality to mixed reality to 3D printed fashion, you know, which is still kind of quite prevalent today, I think. And that really set us on that trajectory to say that, hey, you know, there is a lot more that can be done, right, in this field, because there's a burgeoning amount of interest. But more importantly, I think Singapore is well-placed really to bring it together, because there is a great infrastructure in Singapore from a digital technology perspective. And I think there's also a lot of appetite, you know, from the local audiences to experience, you know, new technologies. And I think it's something that they embrace in the museums as well. So I think that was really interesting.
Can you please tell the year when exactly this was done?
Right. So DigiMuse, I think, started in 2017. The first open call went out in 2018. I think it was the year after. And I think in end 2018, as well as early 2019, we had something called DigiMuse Presents, which is where we presented the projects that were developed by local artists and creators.
Okay, thank you. It's great to understand the timeline, because as you said, many things are still relevant today.
So one of the things that I think I still hold today as being one of the more meaningful projects from a museum or heritage board perspective is that we are very conscious that we didn't want technology to be there just for the sake of it, right? And also, it shouldn't be technology for technology's sake. So, you know, as we started to look at various technologies and how it can be applied, I think a lot of technologies pitched to us, you know, it's like virtual reality, you know, mixed reality, you know, it's the new thing. So you must have it. But I guess our kind of question then was, why? What can that give us that a physical visit does not, right? And I think if you can find that landing point, I think that's where then technology becomes relevant and it's not just there for the sake of it. So one of the projects that we were quite happy to support is something called Project Insight. It was a proposed by local creators having understood that there was an element in the museum visits that were missing. So a lot of people, when you visit a museum, when they come to the National Museum, you look at the artwork. You don't really think about the things that go into it before the artwork goes on display. So there's hundreds of hours of conservation work that goes into taking care of the artwork, to restoring it to its condition where it can go on display. So there was a particular painting, for instance, at the National Museum. It was a portrait of Song Ong Siang, one of the early pioneers. And I think that particular work went through many hundreds of hours of treatment, you know, conservation treatment, restoration work before it can actually be put on display. So what we did was we introduced the use of mixed reality lenses, and visitors were able to put on that headset and actually view that artwork, which is, of course, on display at a museum. And once they put it on, they actually see a layer of content, you know, that is superimposed on it. And they basically see the artwork in its unrestored state. You know, some of the structural damages, your visitors were able to overlay a UV view, for instance, to see the structural damages. And likewise, if it were able to show them an infrared view to show where the painting defects. And they were also able to actively, or virtually, I should say, restore the painting, right? So they became a conservator in action at the museum. So this gave them a deeper appreciation, that there's a lot of effort that goes into conservation and we should not take that for granted. So that was something that we thought was meaningful, because for most visitors, you would not have that perspective. You would not understand at all, or even be aware of the role of a conservator that's very integral to what museums do. And I think that was something that's a good example, that we find that technology is able to supplement or to be meaningfully employed.
You've actually just touched on a topic that we'd like to explore further. And this relates to what you've just said, that technology shouldn't be for technology's sake when it comes to museums, and that it's important how you use it to enhance relevance. When you talk about museums, they have this unique charm in their physical form, and some of us like visiting museums in person. So how do you ensure that the essence and charm of a physical museum are not lost in the digital space?
Yeah, great question. And I think something we kind of struggle with as well all the time. I know, particularly, I think with COVID, things started to kind of really pivot towards the whole digital space, and which was essential at that point in time just to make sure that content and heritage and history is accessible. But I agree with you. I think the fact is, when people come to the museum, we want them to enjoy the physical space, right? Otherwise, there's no point to having a museum. The point is they need to be there physically present and being able to appreciate the effort that's gone into curating the experience, the exhibition that's been put together very painstakingly by many people, the curators, the designers, the creators, the artists. Where we see digital coming in really is where it can add a layer that is otherwise not present, or it can extend the visit, whether it's a pre-visit or a post-visit, for example. So what do I mean by that? I think a typical museum visit, for example, lasts about an hour and a half, 2 hours perhaps, at least in the Singapore context. But we think there's a lot more that you can discover, right? And one of the things that I've always kind of advocated for is that when you visit a museum or an exhibition for that matter, I want you to leave with more questions than you had before you came in. So the idea behind it is that the exhibitions or museums are not there to tell you what is. It's there to provoke thought, provoke a response, and provoke that curiosity from you. And what do you do after you leave with all the many questions that hopefully you have? And that will prompt you to want to find out more. So that's where I see the digital layer coming in, because that really helps us kind of contextualize where digital is relevant, because Take, for example, a school, if you're bringing your students in. And when you're at the museum, you know that you have a very short amount of time there. You know students have very short attention span. We want you to focus, you know, on the physical experience. But before you visit the museum or after you visit the museum, I think those are where the digital toolkits come in, where you allow the teachers to make use of these and to have the students be able to experience these in a different way and continue the exploration of heritage. So that, to me, I think is primarily one of the key drivers for where we are looking at from a digital experience perspective. And just to reiterate, the last thing we want is people to stare at their phones and you know, go through the museum staring at their phone, because that's not the point, right? I think the other one is where we say that if you talk about our collections, right, not everything is accessible. So for instance, when we created the Team Lab installation, Story of the Forest, I know we'll probably talk about it a little bit more, but the whole kind of notion behind Story of the Forest, which is basically a digital immersive space that brings out, I guess, the collection of natural history drawings that resides with the National Museum of Singapore. The whole idea behind that is that the physical paintings, okay, so it's not readily accessible all the time. So the for a bit of context, the collection itself is called the William Farquhar Collection of Natural History Drawings. That's basically a collection of 477 drawings of flora and fauna of Malaya. Right, so not just Singapore, but basically our neighbours in Malaya. And this was commissioned by William Farquhar, who was the first resident in Singapore during the colonial era. But because they are paintings, and for paintings, it's they are very delicate, you know, to and very sensitive. So for every year, for instance, that we bring out that particular painting, it needs to go back to storage, to the conservation lab, to rest for 3 years before I can bring it out again. So the entire collection, at any one point in time, we could probably present only about 30, 40 works at most. What about the rest? So I think that's where the digital layer comes in. And when we thought about creating this immersive space, I think it's really with the intention to say that if we can digitize the experience of all these flora and fauna, of the paintings, of the collection, and bring it to life, and we can actually allow visitors to experience, you know, that collection in its entirety and to bring it to life, you know, to have it have a sort of more immersive, kind of engaging experience for visitors. And that was really the motivation for us, you know, to say that digital is relevant there, because it allows people to connect with the artworks in a different way and to also bring to life something which otherwise they would not be able to connect with simply because the collection itself is difficult to access, right? So with that in mind, I think those were earlier explorations in digital experiences. And I think where we are moving more towards nowadays, I think the things that keep me busy nowadays is really looking at how can we do more to digitize our heritage, you know, whether it's tangible or intangible heritage. We have been exploring a lot in terms of use of 3D technologies, you know, 3D scanning of our artifacts of our buildings, simply with the intention to say that, okay, if we have really good quality documentation, not just in photographs, but really in 3D, which the technology today allows, we can make this available and accessible, you know, to a larger range of parties and or communities or people who might want to access it. So I think this one major area that I think a lot of museums are going into. We see museums like the British Museum, the Smithsonian Institutions, and so on, and many others who are also exploring in this field. The other kind of area that benefits from such technologies is in the preservation of sites, you know, historic sites, monuments. I think we have seen examples internationally of historic sites being destroyed due to war and conflict, for example. And I think the only way, you know, to kind of capture these is, thankfully, you know, through digital technologies, we are able to restore some of these. I think one of the more recent examples is in the Notre Dame, where I think, unfortunately, you know, there was a fire that kind of destroyed a large part of the cathedral. But I think recently, Grand Palais Immersive, I think they presented an exhibition making use of virtual reality technologies to recreate the Notre Dame Cathedral and to also show the restoration process of how it was able to kind of be restored, you know, thankfully due to a lot of very good quality digital documentation, and they've turned it into a VR experience in itself. So those are kind of really interesting applications, and we are seeing a lot more of these emerging along the way.
So I have a question about funding, especially since you've mentioned the restoration of Notre Dame, which was significantly supported by external donations. Most of your projects are government funded, aren't they? Or do external sponsors also help?
Fundamentally, yes, because we are fully funded and as a statutory board by the government. That being said, we do have partners along the way as well, you know, who, whether is it corporations or kind of technology partners who have also come in, you know, to support the efforts. But in principle, you are correct. You know, because we are a statutory board, we are largely funded by the government.
So we've talked a lot about the success as well as some tips on making technology work for museums. Reflecting on your work so far, is there anything you'd like to do differently if you were given another chance?
I think in my framing, I don't look at them as failures. I think in the innovation process, you know, as you look at it, it's expected that certain things will fail. And the whole point of trying out our experimentation or is so that you can have more failures to so that you learn from it and then you kind of improve and drive yourself on. So I think that really is embedded as part of the kind of innovation journey that we encourage. So I always tell my guys or the partners that we work with is that, hey, you know, if you have a wild idea, let's just try it and then we'll figure it out. You know, along the way, if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But the whole point of it is we will iterate from there. And I think a lot of things didn't work. You know, obviously, when we started looking at VR projects, for example, we very quickly realized that VR headsets, you know, are just not the most intuitive. They spoil easily, the whole maintenance of it, the whole operations of VR headsets is problematic, right, for a lot of museums, right? Particularly, you know, in the light of COVID as well, you know, is how much do we want to kind of really push for some of these? Is the technology ready, for example, right? Or are the people ready, you know, for things like that? I think recently I've just been reading something about the death of the metaverse before it even started. So I think it's also very kind of fatalistic articles, but I don't look at it as failures. And I think the metaverse as a term, I don't really like it, but in principle, I think it is really an evolving space, right? It's something that will take a while, you know, to kind of grow and build. And I think more importantly, I think people will need to take some time, you know, to see the relevance of it before we can decide or judge, you know, whether or not it's a failure or not.
So we'd like to hear more about something you mentioned earlier, and that's about your work with contemporary artists. How do you start collaborations? What makes an artist or an art collective the right choice for your project?
I think the artistic space, honestly, when we went into it in the early years of DigiMuse, I think it was primarily because, as I mentioned, the local context, there weren't that many initiatives in art and technology. And I think therefore we saw our role really as the National Museum of Singapore to provide those opportunities and platforms to bring artists and technologists together, you know, to create relevance in terms of how they connect with, I guess, the national collection, with heritage and all. Then it was quite opportunistic. There were a lot of kind of initiatives that we were working with from an artistic perspective to talk to artists and see whether their visions align with us, right? So one of the kind of projects, you know, that I obviously mentioned earlier included Story of the Forest, which is done by Team Lab, which is a Japanese art collective. I think the kind of gestation behind that is really to say that I think Team Lab at that point in time, they were doing really interesting work, you know, in the digital immersive space. And we saw their particular expertise as something that was really relevant to how we see ourselves wanting the collection to really come out and bring that to life, right? And in our engagements, I think it was us putting forward, you know, our kind of ideas and our vision behind what we want, which is basically for the National Collection to come to life. And then Team Lab, you know, as a art collective, were able to kind of bring in, you know, their own blend of aesthetics, of design, of art to kind of form that partnership with us. But at the core of it is really us basically saying that we want the core of the experience to be centered on the National Collection, which is, as I mentioned earlier, the William Farquhar Collection of Natural History Drawings. So we didn't want a digital experience in isolation. We wanted something that was able to resonate, you know, with the mission of the museums. And I think that's pretty much the same principle that we take in every kind of digital engagement or any artistic endeavor, which is the case where we need the artists to be able to work with the context of how the museums are important or relevant to Singaporeans, how the museum's core mission is also achieved, right? And each museum is different. So earlier I mentioned the National Museum of Singapore, obviously I have the most experience there. But also, you know, when you talk about our other museums and institutions like the Asian Civilizations Museum, the Peranakan Museum, each has its own context, each has its own set of stakeholders or objectives. And I think that's where the suitable artists will need to be found to be able to get them to appreciate or to understand that they appreciate the context of the museum. And from there, you know, we evolve the work together.
Given your experience with Team Lab and their immersive digital art, how do you see augmented reality shaping future museum experiences? What role do you think AR can play in engaging visitors with museum collections?
Back, I guess, in 2014, 2015, I think Google, at that point in time, they launched something called Project Tango. So perhaps, yeah, I guess listeners can go and Google it. But basically, it was their first attempt at embedding augmented reality technologies into the mobile phone environment, to mobile phone platforms. So I think it was it's the precursor to what today, you know, we take for granted, you know, as I guess the various AR cores that the mobile phone developers have embedded. But I think back then, you know, it was something quite new. As part of this kind of Project Tango, I think it's basically the notion that certain mobile devices can have access to augmented reality, and you kind of overlay, you know, that experience, you know, through your mobile device. So back then, I think we spoke to the Google team, and I think they very kindly supported our initiative. And what we did was we actually captured various aspects of the museum as it used to be in the 1950s, you know, through photographs and all that. We actually kind of rendered that into something that was embedded into the augmented reality experience. So for visitors, essentially, when they came to the museum, we introduced what we call an architectural tour of the museum. So the National Museum of Singapore was basically a building that has been around for more than 130 years. It was basically there since 1887, and it has always been a museum. So it's a really historic venue. But of course, the museum has evolved, right? It started off initially as a more of an ethnographic museum with a large natural history collection, and today it's more of a social history museum. So what we wanted to do with the architectural tour was really to say, hey, today, if you enter the museum, you'll see what it is today, but can we transport you to how it used to be in the 1950s, for example? And back then, it was a natural history museum, so you had things like entire whale skeleton structure. You know, we had tigers and whatnot, you know, all around. So with that, I think the basic notion was, hey, can augmented reality help us bring visitors to visit the museum as it used to be in 1950s, right? And I think that was really the initial experience, you know, that we brought in. So that was something that we were really excited to try. And I think it had its successes, but it had its failures as well, simply because the platform became obsolete very quickly, right? And as technology platforms evolved, I think, but the assets are still there, right? So we still have the experience in terms of the digital assets that were created for that. And we have since, you know, kind of really looked at reusing it as well. So that's one area where people who visit the museum, you know, you could use AR to add on a layer of experience that you otherwise not be able to access, right? And I think that's really important. But the other thing that's important with that's interesting about augmented reality is that now everybody can take home a part of the collection in your mobile phone, and you can access that anywhere, not just at the museum. And that's where I think AR becomes really interesting, because it starts to open up opportunities to gamify how people access the collection. So I think one of the things we've been doing a lot is to identify ways that people can make use of AR when they are not with the museum, and to use it in helping their conversations along. So for example, recently we've been prototyping and testing out, you know, the use of cards. You know, so it's like cards that are designed with certain aspects of augmented reality. So you can use it to kind of play a game, but at the same time, if you scan the card, you know, an AR artifact will pop up, and that kind of leads you to kind of be able to explore, you know, that the artifact on your mobile phone, and you click through on it, it brings you to the Roots website where you get to find out more information about, let's say, that particular dish, you know, let's say it's a particular traditional dish. And then from there, you can click through to a YouTube video that shows you how to actually prepare the dish. You know? So I think it's that kind of extension that we see it being where we see AR having the potential, you know, to really bring it to relevance outside of the museum. And I do find that may be something quite interesting as augmented reality becomes more ubiquitous, you know, as it's become more mainstream and available, and people are very used to using AR, whether it's for games, you know, for Pokemon Go, or whatever is the kind of new experiences that are out there. And I think we would be remiss to just dismiss, you know, AR often. I think it does have a lot of potential.
So far, you've been exploring many of these frontier technologies like AR, IoT, immersive environments. And you've also mentioned that there are also many challenges in doing these technologies as well, like how quickly they become obsolete and all that. So can you please share with us maybe an instance or two where a new technology application didn't go as planned?
I guess in a way, we plan it such that every time we launch a project, we would have to anticipate, you know, what is the life cycle, you know, of that project. And that could be on a variety of fronts, because when you talk about technology, for instance, hardware itself, there is probably an obsolescence, you know, timeline, you know, to say that, you know, probably after 3 years, after 5 years, you know, the hardware definitely will not be able to support the experience anymore. We will have to refresh it. And when we refresh it, there's probably a new platform, a new software that we need to build up. You know, there are different patches and all that. And these are actually real pragmatic issues we have to face when we talk about, I guess, the use of digital and technologies, because all this also translates to cost, right, and effort to maintain these platforms. So I think previously I shared, we've done some virtual reality experiences. We have used VR in certain instances. I think beyond the kind of technology obsolescence part of it, I think a lot of it is also whether or not the people are ready, to embrace, these platforms. With virtual reality, for instance, I think there's still a lot of work that needs to be done to get people to be comfortable, in a VR environment, because it's very different. Some people feel disoriented in such an environment. And I think there's probably a lot of work that needs to be done in terms of not just presenting the content, but really making it such that it's a space that people feel comfortable in more than 20 minutes, right, for it to have relevance. And there's a lot of work to be done. It's not just about the visuals. It's also about the overall sensory design of the space. It's about how you make sure that the audio is synchronized, with the visuals, so that you don't have a very kind of disconnected experience that kind of creates that disorientation and all that. So I think there's a lot of these designs that we are still learning and we are still working through. I think another area that we have tried out and which hasn't necessarily worked is really the use of these technologies to support accessibility initiatives. So for instance, somebody who is visually impaired, I think we have tried out quite a number of, there are various technologies to allow for people who are visually impaired to navigate the museums, for example. Still not quite there. I think there's still a lot of rough edges. A lot of it is also about, for instance, if you bring somebody who's visually impaired, they're very comfortable using what they are familiar with, right? Which is, let's say, their own, I guess, walking devices or their own ways that they are navigating it. But the moment you throw them another device, there's a whole reorientation process, there's a whole relearning that needs to be done, and that's just not necessarily practicable. So I think in the area of accessibility, I think there's potential, but there's also a lot of more work to be done, to allow for people to be able to benefit from the technology there. And I think those are things which we are still constantly learning for.
Moving beyond virtual reality and augmented reality, what do you believe is the next significant development for museums and heritage sites in the future?
I think for museums and heritage sites, or just heritage appreciation in general, I think digital and technologies, I think one of the main benefits is that it's able to break down barriers, right? I think in terms of geography, of space, of time, and these are kind of elements, which are very essential. So if you talk about heritage experiences, I think typically we look at it, it's either from a perspective of place or perspective of time. And so if we were talking about, let's say, a heritage site, right? I think I would want to know where is it, where physically, it is centered, but also how it has evolved, across time, and how else has the landscape around it evolved, for example. So, and where digital and technology comes in is that it's really able to break down, these barriers and to kind of allow people to be transported and transcend, these kind of very kind of physical constraints. The other aspect is that technology allows for the proliferation or transmission, at scale, communication at scale. I'm able today to create an experience that can be accessible anywhere in the world. And that's groundbreaking. I mean, that's really something that is unimaginable, I think, if you were to look at the early conceptions of museums, because museums were pretty much a space which focused on the physical. And they still are, but today, I can have a museum located on one end of the earth, connect with another museum, and people can actually talk or interact or engage with each other. And that really, I think, is something that is obviously not just centered on museums. It's really the way that society has evolved, the globalization, and the way that technology has started to bring together these various aspects. And I think museums can benefit from this, right? Because it's really about bridging cultures. It's really about bridging people's understanding with each other. And I guess for me, there are really two areas to look at. One, which we probably don't have a lot of time to go into, but it's really about the whole AI evolution, right? I mean, where does it open AI and all that? I think what it has given us at this point in time is a peek into the possibilities of how people engage with heritage content, with history, with various media will change, right? The way people create content will change. And I think museums can look at it either as a threat or as an opportunity, but either way, I think realistically speaking, we cannot ignore that. So one of the things we are trying to position ourselves to look at is, okay, if AI is going to be part of our lives in terms of how people use that, to whether it's create content or to search for content or to kind of have a conversation with history, so to speak. How can we enable that in a way that is protected, that's safe, that is something that will not run away from us, right? So a lot of the work we are doing in AI, I guess, moving forward, and which we kind of think a lot of museums would be looking at as well, is what is the whole range of digital content that we have? Is it text-based content, audio content, videos, images, 3D models, you know, and how can we bring that together within an ecosystem, right, that allows for all of this to be accessible, searchable, and more importantly, for it to be a very kind of robust kind of ecosystem, you know, of content that really gets people to be able to engage with the museums at a much deeper level. So I feel that is definitely one area that we need to look at.
Well, AI is a big topic right now, especially with the rise of technologies like chatbots and ChatGPT. Can you tell us when you first started exploring the use of AI?
Well, we first started in the very initial years was in 2017, I think, when we started DigiMuse. At that point in time, I think we were looking at conversational AI. So it's really, you know, how do we kind of use AI in chatbots, you know, that allows people to query artworks, you know, or query aspects and to kind of, you know, get them to basically engage with our collection in a deeper way. But of course, no, at that point in time, I think the technology was still quite preliminary. I think it was there. I think there were straightforward applications, but definitely not as kind of fantastic as they are now. But there are challenges as well, obviously, right, with AI. And I think it goes down to the bread and butter issues as well in terms of how, I think, what's its impact on artists, creators, designers. I think those are definitely things that we cannot run away from. But I guess purely from a museum perspective, in terms of content, and of which, you know, obviously we are the responsible for safeguarding, you know, heritage in general, I think it does present really interesting opportunities, not just from the point of how people access, you know, heritage content, but also how do we inspire the next generation to create, you know, new content based on assets, digital assets that we might have, you know, within the collection. The whole idea is that can we democratize the use of heritage assets, you know, through digital. Because today, you know, if it's all physical, I think there's people don't have access to it as much. But if, let's say, we have an entire digital collection and it's not just about 3D assets, it's about how that comes together with media, you know, images and all that. Imagine the amount of things that students can do with it, right? And how can they make it relevant to themselves? And how can they bring it forward? How can they transmit it? How can they adapt it, you know, for something that's relevant for their generation and to be passed down for future generations? So I think those are really important kind of perspective that we need to take when we talk about technologies like AI.
So Gervais, one final question that we ask everyone on this podcast. If money was no object, what kind of museum or cultural space would you create?
Yeah, it's one of those questions where it's gives us the opportunity to really think, you know, and imagine out of the usual constraints. And for me, I think I would draw back to having been in, you know, arts and culture for about 12 years. I think for me, the connections I make with it is really about the lived experience, right? It's not just how we have documented it, but it's really how people connect with it, how people are able to see their relevance or see themselves, you know, in all of these experiences. And so for me, I think I would love to kind of bring together this idea of what might be, for instance, a museum of lived experiences, meaning that it's not just about, you know, the digital content or the digital heritage. It's not just about the physical heritage, but it's really how people connect with it and how their stories are able to come out, right, in that. So I would say it's something that is a little bit different. It's not just solely focused on, let's say, a national collection, but it's really, for instance, a museum that allows for people to really connect with each other and to share their stories. And for those stories to come to life, whether it's in a digital form or a physical form, but the whole aspect of having lived experiences and being able to touch on how personal heritage comes to light, I think that's really important for me. So I started off this whole podcast talking also about, for instance, subcultures and microhistories. And I think for me, that really resonates with me. How can we allow a space where all these stories can come out and along the way, you know, see it as a museum that is evolving, right, along the way.
It would be great to see your museum of lived experiences to come alive. As we're finishing up, is there one last thing you'd like to share with our listeners? Any message or a piece of advice?
My advice or my thoughts really on this is that we shouldn't be afraid to try new things. I think that's something probably a lot of people say, but I think it's also something that is very real because you never know where it will take you, right? Where the journey will take you. I started DigiMuse really back then as an idea. I didn't have a very long-term vision of it. It's just something I wanted to try out. It has since evolved into my full-time job, which I enjoy and which I am fortunate to be able to continue doing things that I enjoy. But really it's that, right? I think as you start to chase, you know, different ideas down different paths, you'll hit your roadblocks along the way. But I think more importantly, is don't look at them as failures or roadblocks. I think each experience is something that gives you the opportunity to learn something new and to build upon. And I think that's really essential for any museum professional or any arts and culture or heritage professional, because there will be many roadblocks along the way. Some may be policy driven, or some may be regulatory, or some may be just technology, or so on. But the whole idea is that you hold true, right, to what you believe in, and you just keep going. Yeah.
Absolutely. We couldn't agree more. Thank you so much, Gervais.
Thank you, Gervais. It was great to have you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to For Art's Sake. If you liked this episode, make sure to subscribe and catch up on our previous seasons. You can also connect with us on Instagram at forartsake.uk and on Twitter at @sake_arts. Thanks again, and we can't wait to have you back for more.